Welcome to episode 27 of Girls on Pop. I'm your co-host, Freen Antunes, joined today by fellow co-host.
I am Ashley Lynch.
And Miss Lynch, where can folks find you?
Best place to find me is probably on the Twitter sphere. You can find me at Ashley Lynch.
And I am also on the Twitters, and I'm at the Marina. But let's jump right into the goods because there's so much to talk about. Yeah. And we're going to start with
something we hadn't done before.
I don't actually think we've, like, even before the pandemic, I don't even think we'd ever done that.
But we started, like, doing this podcast during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so as a result, we had never gone to see a movie together. Now that has changed. We have gone to see something at the same time.
We've popped that cherry.
Yes, absolutely.
And it was glorious, I tell you, glorious. Because we went to see Everything Everywhere All at Once, the new Daniels film. Okay, do you want to take a stab at explaining what this thing is even about?
Okay.
Is there a plot, like a succinct plot description for this thing?
I mean, there kind of is. It's basically about a immigrant woman played by Michelle Yeoh, who has a daughter in a small business with a laundry and is struggling, and life hasn't turned out the way it is. And then she is dealing with IRS stuff. Suddenly she is essentially confronted and assaulted by the actuality of a multiverse and a grand plot where she has to basically defeat a big bad by linking with her alter egos across the universe to access their memories and skills. And what unfolds is the most bonkers thrill ride of comedy and action that I have potentially ever seen in my life.
I could go with that. I could definitely go with that. And that was
the best stab at describing this thing.
And, you know, and like on a plot basis, that's exactly what it's about for me. First off, I know you love this movie a lot, like a lot. What was it about it that like really grabbed you?
Well, okay. So I suppose first I have to go back and talk about the Daniels as a filmmaking team. And it's, of course, Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert, who have been making music videos for a long time. And I just stumbled upon their music videos early on in their career and fell in love with a very kind of aggressive visual style that they had that reminded me in a lot of ways of the same sort of enthusiasm that Sam Raimi had in his early films. And a lot of stuff that Edgar Wright does as well, where it is very, I don't want to say meta commentary, but it's very self-aware. It's very aggressive, very playful. They're constantly throwing things at you a mile a minute. And they were doing some of the most interesting work I'd ever seen in music videos. I was very excited. And it was very cool to see them suddenly have like a video that blew up huge when they did Turn Down for What, which turned into like that music video turned into like a legitimate like viral moment for the internet where everyone was watching that thing and was freaking out about it. It's like finally people figured out how great the Daniels are. And then they had their first film, Swiss Army Man, which I do like, but it lacked that visual style that they brought to their films. And I always just assumed that was like, kind of like a casualty of like, here's our first film we're making and we're still trying to prove ourselves in the film world, which is different from the music video world. And it's probably at a lower budget. And it had some neat kind of, you know, esoteric ideas that those guys are known for, but it lacked a kind of like the aggressiveness and subversiveness that I was really hoping that they would bring to films. So I liked it, but I didn't love it. And Everything Everywhere All at Once is the complete fulfillment of everything they were doing in their music videos. It is what I wanted from their film career. As far as I'm concerned, I consider this to be their first feature film. Again, didn't dislike Swiss Army Man, but this is on a whole other level. And one thing I uncovered that I think kind of like tracks this down is apparently all the effects, and there's a lot of effects work in this movie, a movie which is ostensibly a pretty small budget movie, considering what's in it, $25 million. All the effects in this movie were done by 6 or 7 people.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Daniel said was that they became so frustrated trying to do the effects for a film like this in a traditional post-production VFX pipeline with all the post houses they were dealing with, that they ultimately scrapped that and just went to all of their music video friends and got a small team of 6 or 7 people to put together all the effects for this stuff the way they would do in their music videos. And that's why it has that look. That's why they were able to achieve it at this budget level, which is nothing short of astounding.
Yeah, it also explains the fact that it feels like this movie is more controlled than Swiss Army Man, which I also was fine. Like, I didn't love it. I thought it was a really interesting concept. And I liked the concept more than I liked the execution. And I think they caught my attention because of that, because the storytelling is just so unique. And I'm not familiar with their music videos, so I came into it not really knowing who they were, other than they've made this movie that I kind of liked, that I thought was interesting. And okay, let's see what they have going on here. And this thing is... it's really unlike anything I've ever seen before, like ever. Like, I've never seen a movie like this. And that alone is enough for me to recommend it. It's just so off the wall crazy. I think some of it sticks better than other bits, but generally speaking, like, the full package delivers the goods. I'm still kind of processing, because I think it's really fascinating that, and I mean, I haven't seen Swiss Army Man since it came out. I don't remember what the theme of that movie was. I have no idea. I don't remember if you were to ask me. This is so ingrained in my mind. I'm never going to forget that this is a mother-daughter story. It is such a sweet family drama wrapped up in this craziness, multiverse, with these like ridiculous moments. You're never gonna forget this movie, ever.
Yeah, there's so much going on in this.
Yes,
the biggest thing I kind of took away from it is like, it's just a little over 2 hours, but by the time I got to the end of the movie, I felt like I just had like 8 hours of movie crammed into 2 hours, but in a way where nothing felt like it was truncated or glossed over or shortened or just like pushed past really fast. It's just like, it's just chock full of content. And I can't think of another movie where I've really felt that way. And I was genuinely exhausted by the end of the movie, but in a good way. It's truly a journey of a film. And you feel like you've been on this grand journey where you were so far away from where you were at the beginning. And it's just... like you said, there's no other film that you can really compare this to. And I mean that both in terms of quality and subject material. It sits alone in a subgenre of its own. There's not another film I can think of that is actually like this. Even though I can point to some films that, you know, are kind of like lead to this in terms of inspiration. They're clearly drawing a lot of inspiration from the works of the Wachowskis, from Wong Kar-wai, from Edgar Wright, you know. So it's the influences, I think, are very apparent there. However, this is a singular and unique film unto its own. And I can't remember the last time I've been so excited coming out of a movie feeling like I had just seen something so incredibly fresh and new and invigorating and got me this excited. And it's like, maybe Spider-Verse. If I'm being real, I'm going back to the first Matrix movie in 1999, the way I felt walking out of that movie.
Yeah,
that's how I felt coming out of this movie.
Yeah,
and I'd said this to you before, but like, if this had come out in 2021, it easily would have been my number one movie of the year. And I have a hard time believing anything else is going to top it for me this year. if it does, this year will be an embarrassment of riches. Without me, there'll be another movie that is this good.
Yeah.
And I have to see it again and give it some time to settle, but I'm pretty sure this movie is going to settle into my top 10 favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, no, it definitely has a lot going for it. I really, really enjoyed it. I didn't love it as much as you did, but there's so many just moments that are ingrained into my mind that I'm just never going to forget. It's so unique. It's such a cool, fun ride.
Well, and I find it interesting that we've gotten to this moment in time with the types of stories we're telling in films where, and we'll touch on this a little bit too with another film that I saw this week, where essentially the story comes down to, it's like, hey, your parents don't actually have their shit figured out and they are still processing the trauma handed down to them by their parents. And sometimes they make really shitty decisions. And sometimes it's legitimately okay to not listen to your parents because they don't know, they're doing their best and don't know what the fuck they're doing either. And that's not the prototypical, Western Christian message that had got pushed for so long, which is always like respect your elders, regardless of whether or not you think they're right. And we're seeing a lot of stories kind of pull back the veil on that one and go, you know what, your parents are fucking up too.
And we all make mistakes.
Very much plays into that because it's very much a mother-daughter relationship film at the heart of all this craziness. But it is about the fact that Michelle Yeoh is this woman who's like, you know, in her 50s and she's still trying to like figure shit out and where she fits into the world and is trying to do better for her daughter, but also in a lot of ways is like passing on the trauma that her father gave to her onto her daughter. And it's about her coming to terms with that and trying to figure out what's actually best for her daughter and for her family. And it does so in such a sweet way that is ultimately incredibly empathetic, incredibly optimistic, incredibly humanistic.
Yeah.
In a way that you don't expect from a movie that is a wacky sci-fi comedy kung fu movie.
Yeah, pretty much. And can I say, my mind was totally blown. I went out with a friend yesterday and this trailer came on before the movie we were about to watch. And she's like, you know, that's Short Round. And my mouth fell open. I was like, how the fuck did I miss this? And now that I know, I see it everywhere.
I knew this before I went in, and then I completely forgot as we were watching it. And then I remembered afterwards. It's like, oh, yeah, that's right. So it's like, yeah, Ke-Hei Kwan, who was originally like Short Round and in the Goonies, and then basically just disappeared from North American film shortly after. He was like Encino Man and just like, fuck that, I'm out. And here he is. He's come back in this role where he's playing Michelle Yeoh's husband. And he's fantastic in the movie.
He is so good.
He's also playing like multiple versions of himself from different universes. And he does a thing where he just like switches on a dime. The personality, and he does so with like such severity, and his comedic timing with it is so good. And it's just like he was so entertaining in the movie.
Agreed.
I absolutely loved it. And there's so many jokes that feel like they're throwaway jokes, and then the joke will build upon itself, and then the joke will become a whole thing in the film. And I don't want to get too specific because I don't want to spoil it for anyone. And the trailer is actually a really good trailer for this film. It really kind of sets you up for, okay, that's what this film is. But it does not even hint at how crazy this movie is going to get. And some of the things you're going to see and some of the jokes that are going to be running through it. And it's wonderful for just the craziness to just wash over you. That's part of the experience of it. It's almost an impossible movie to spoil anyways.
You could talk about all of the details and you still wouldn't get everything.
I could describe this movie to you beat for beat and it still would not make sense the way it does when you watch it.
Oh, so Everything Everywhere All at Once, recommended by both of us.
Very high.
See it. Yeah, see it when it opens near you. I think it expands to a wider release this week. So
yeah, it's extremely limited in theaters right now. I think it's only open on, God, I want to say something like about 20 screens.
Oh, wow.
Something like that.
Oh, wow.
It's not a lot. And the movie is so far, like, it's only made like $500,000. But that's not because it's doing badly. It's just because it's on so few screens right now. And actually, the per screen average is really high for this film. I mean, we saw it on a Thursday night and the theater was packed. We didn't even get great seats.
No.
It was so packed. So the film is actually doing really well. And they're doing like a slow kind of build word of mouth opening, which I think is right for this film because this film has incredible word of mouth.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard anyone not rave about this movie.
Yeah, no, it's true. For good reason, to be totally honest. I think it's fantastic. Yeah. Okay, so talk to me about The Bubble, which is another new release.
Yeah, so The Bubble is a new Judd Apatow movie on Netflix. Judd Apatow finally going back to doing a comedy. And this one is basically a Hollywood satire about a film production that is taking place on a almost Jurassic Park-like movie called Cliff B6. But it's like, it's set up as being like one of two movies in production at the beginning of the lockdown. And like the studio has everything riding on this film because it's the only film they have in production. And they've basically just like created this little bubble at this place in London where they're shooting, where the actors aren't allowed to leave. And they're just going to make this movie. And that's the way they've determined they can safely do this. And everyone just slowly kind of like goes insane over the course of trying to make this film. The film, it's okay. It's fine. I thought the trailer looked great and I was excited about it. I especially have this deep love of movies, about making movies. You know, because I work in film and it's just like, the incestuousness of it, I get it, but I find it fun. But the movie, ultimately, it's like, it's not funny enough to really call a comedy. It's not biting enough to really call a satire. It's more like light snark. And it's okay. It's entertaining enough, but still kind of meh. And ultimately, it doesn't really have anything to say other than, hey, the lockdown sucked, didn't it? It's like, and not just that, but like the lockdown at the beginning of the pandemic when everyone was paranoid and afraid and didn't know what was going on. That sucked, didn't it? Well, yeah, it did. I didn't need a movie for that. The only thing that really keeps the thing going is like the cast is absolutely stacked for this movie. And they're incredibly enjoyable to watch. Watching them bounce off each other. You got Karen Gillan and Fred Armisen, Pedro Pascal, Keegan-Michael Key, David Duchovny, Leslie Mann. You know, it's like, so you have this incredible comedic cast doing stuff, but it feels so aimless. I don't know. It ultimately ended up being a fairly big nothing burger, so I was hoping for a little bit more from it.
Oh, I remember watching the trailer and thinking, oh, that actually looks like a lot of fun. And then I completely forgot about it until I saw it on your list just a minute ago. And I was like, oh, shit, I forgot that came out. Oops. 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 I watched Dog, which is the new Channing Tatum movie, because, of course, Channing Tatum. Why would I say no to that?
Movie Pig.
No, not at all related to the movie Pig. Admittedly, so this kind of came. I like Channing Tatum. I think he's great, more than just good looking. Even though he is very good looking, that helps. So he also co-directed this with Reed Carden, who is his, I guess, producing partner. They've been working together for a number of years, and it's really solid. Like, it's a really sweet movie. You know, Channing Tatum plays this soldier dealing with PTSD. He's trying to move on with his life and get his job as like a consultant. And in order to get this job, he ends up having to do this gig where he is taking a dog, like a service dog, across the country to his partner's funeral. And the dog is, of course, troubled because reasons. Dogs also have PTSD. So it's like this really charming sort of like buddy road trip movie with Channing Tatum and a dog. And it's super cute and really charming and really well shot and totally worth checking out. It's really, really good. Channing Tatum's doing his thing. The movie is great. The dog is great. It looks good. And they've done quite a bit with a little bit of money. So I say, surprisingly, this is a good one.
Nice.
Yeah. Jackass Forever. Talk to me about the dicks.
So I watched Jackass Forever. I don't know.
I understand. I mean, I understand that there are a lot of dicks. I haven't seen this yet, so.
I have a love-hate relationship with the Jackass movies where it's like, I don't quote-unquote like any of them. I don't like the concept of Jackass. At the same time, there is a visceral physical comedy that comes from some of the stuff in the Jackass movies that is undeniable. It's impossible to watch one of these movies and not at some point, you know, bust out laughing because it's just the sheer,
it's ridiculous
physical comedy.
Yeah.
So there's entertainment to be had, and especially with all the shit that is happening in the world, sometimes you just want to watch some dudes punching each other in the nuts. That said, I watched Jackass Forever, and it's a Jackass movie. I don't know what more you can say beyond that. It's everything I just described, where it's equal parts reprehensible and hysterical. I think the most interesting thing about it at this point is watching these guys who are like in their 40s and 50s now. I've basically grown up with these guys. They are my age now, and they're still doing the same shit. And it's like the gag where Johnny Knoxville puts on old man makeup to troll people. He no longer needs the makeup for it. He just is that old man now. And so it's wild to see these guys who are not invincible in their 20s anymore still try to do some of this shit. And some of it's like, why am I watching this? And other things are like, oh my god, this is stupid, but I cannot deny the comedy of it. The bit that I think got me the most was there was an electrified dance floor bit they did, where they had all these guys doing a tap dance routine in bare feet on an electrified floor that they would occasionally like turn on and just watch them like freak out if they're getting electrocuted. And it's very basic comedy, but it works.
I was never a fan of the Jackass movies. I don't find that style of comedy particularly appealing, but I have seen like one or two of them, and they all just kind of feel the same to me. The only appeal that this has is what you just mentioned, the fact that these guys are no longer 20 and they're still doing the same shit they were doing at 20. And that to me holds like a tiny little inkling of interest. So maybe one day when I'm really needing a laugh, I think maybe I can put that in.
Yeah, it's very much sits in the guilty pleasure realm. You know, it depends on where you sit. I know some people are just straight up, no, it's just pleasure. I have no guilt about this whatsoever. Like, whatever, if that's your thing.
Yeah, if it works for you.
My thing, But at the same time, I'm also not going to pretend that I don't laugh at them.
Yeah, yeah. So let me tell you, I took one. I feel like I took one for the team. Because
Walking Jackass, you took one for the team?
Dude, I fucking watched Moonfall.
I have not pulled the trigger on that yet, and I'm not sure I want to.
Oh, dude, I don't even know what to say. Like, I should preface this by saying, I love a good Roland Emmerich movie. Like, if you're going to make an end-of-the-world movie, few people do it in the style and panache of Roland Emmerich, where there's just so much pleasure on screen at destroying everything. And they're so ridiculous. I love it. If you're going to go for it, you just go all out. And Roland Emmerich is the guy to do that. He knows how to destroy the planet. I'll give him that. So the concept here is that the moon is hollow. It's a superstructure. Uh-huh. It's a superstructure created by aliens. I guess I should maybe spoiler warning, because you have to hear how ridiculous this is. The moon is a superstructure created by aliens. There are two separate alien species in the moon fighting for control. And in the process, they have come off the axis, and basically the moon is going to crash into planet Earth. So how do you save the planet? Well, they send up NASA in a last-ditch effort, brings this old astronaut that's been he's basically not been an astronaut for a long time. He was let go for reasons that you learn about right at the beginning, played by Patrick Wilson. And he and Halle Berry get on a ship with this dude who's like a superstructured genius, and they fly to the moon to try to, you know, solve things. The backup plan is just to nuke the moon. The military just wants to nuke the moon. And the rest of the planet has no say in it whatsoever. There is nothing beyond the U.S. military and whatever we see of the United States. This movie is so ridiculous. Even for a Roland Emmerich movie, it's beyond ridiculous. And to make matters worse, the visual effects aren't even all that great, which is super disappointing to me, because usually, at the very least, I can get like the end of the world destruction looking awesome. I'm not sure what's happened here. Well,
my understanding is that this one actually is technically an independent film.
I could go with that. I could see it.
Holds like the record for being the most expensive independent film of all time.
All right. That explains a lot. Independent film. That explains a lot.
I saw the trailer. I looked at the premise, and it was like, the reason I haven't watched is I'm kind of with you, where I can enjoy, on the same level that I can enjoy a Jackass movie, I can get behind the stupidity of a Roland Emmerich disaster porn movie. At the same time, this premise feels so much like he has jumped the shark.
It has. It's so not good on any level. Halle Berry and Patrick Wilson are so flat. John Bradley provides the comedic relief. Most people will recognize him from Game of Thrones, and he's probably
conspiracy theorist. Right?
He is, and he's legitimately the best part of the movie. And the conspiracy theorists in general are the best part of the movie, because they're just so freaking ridiculous. I don't know. It's so not worth even the running time. It's on Amazon Prime if you want to see it. It's included with your Prime membership, totally free. I don't know. I thought I was going to get like Day After Tomorrow. No, I did not get Day After Tomorrow. I guess I will just have to rewatch Day After Tomorrow. This is not it.
You know, late last night, I wasn't ready for bed yet. I wanted to put on a movie. I was like, well, I could watch Moonfall, or I could watch The Martian again. I watched The Martian.
Probably a better selection than the choice I made. Definitely a better selection than the choice I made. Let's talk West Side Story.
Yeah, so I finally, you know, I'm a little bit behind the curve on some of this stuff, you know, it's like post-Oscars and stuff that had basically been building up. but this one has been out for a while. There's going to be a few of those on my list. But I finally saw Spielberg's West Side Story. And I think I'd probably put it off for a bit because I've never been like a massive West Side Story fan. It's not something that I have any particular love or need for in my life. And so I'm like, it's West Side Story. And people tell me how good it was and whatnot. It's like, And so I did. I finally got around to watching it, and I think at first it felt like more of an obligation than anything. But I wanted to see, like, okay, how good is this? For a West Side Story version, this version is very good. There's absolutely no denying that. On technical proficiency level, I think this movie is off the charts. I think it is possibly some of Spielberg's best work. The cinematography is some of the best work. The staging and choreography and camera work, some of the best work. It is just an astounding film all across the board. And I think on that level, it is a borderline masterpiece. I think it's probably a film that film schools or film students should be studying and breaking down as an example of here's how you do things. Spielberg has long been a master at blocking and staging scenes with actors and camera. It's been quietly one of the things that he's best at his entire career, and I don't think he gets enough recognition
Agreed.
For how good he is with that. And in this, maybe it's because it's a musical and he has a license to push that in a much more kind of obvious direction, where he doesn't have to like hide behind not being like too in the face for the audience. He's operating on a whole other level, and it's absolutely incredible. It did absolutely nothing to change the fact that I still don't care about West Side Story. It's fine. some of the numbers are fine. The story is fine.
I'm totally with you.
I just fell in love with West Side Story, and this movie is just West Side Story. But the film itself,
yes,
incredible.
Agreed. I'm totally in the same boat. I waited a long time to watch this for the same reason. I have no history with West Side Story. Never seen the musical. Never seen the movie that it's based on. Like, just it's not anywhere in my wheelhouse. But I figured, you know, it's Spielberg. He's always good. Let's give this thing a go. I was super impressed. And like you, I think that there is the really great, and I'll see if I can find it. I believe it was part of the on the Oscars YouTube channel. They had an 8-minute clip on the making of the gymnasium dance sequence, which is just like fucking mind blowing. And you're like, okay, well, this is why this guy is the master. And we must not forget that Steven Spielberg is king. Like, he is good at what he does to the point where he makes it look easy and you just forget that he's that good. It just is what it is. It's the reality of it. And like you say, I think that this movie is like working on a whole other level. It looks amazing. I will say I was a little bit unprepared for the emotional baggage at the end. I didn't realize it would be as dark as it is. And it does get pretty dark. Overall, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was way better than I had expected, for sure. It surprised me as somebody who is not, one, a fan of musicals, and two, a fan of West Side Story. So I was impressed. But yeah, the making of, I would love to see like an entire making of this thing, because it just looks amazing. And the fact that it didn't take home any Oscars is a little bit disappointing, honest.
It took home Best Supporting Actress.
Yes, that's right. Sorry. I mean, I meant kind of like on a technical level. For me, I think that was disappointing, but so good.
I think I tweeted this out as I was watching it, but and it was during the gymnasium scene that I was responding to, where I said West Side Story is editing on hard mode, because I can't imagine even trying to edit a film like this. Like, it's one thing, every one of those dance scenes is more or less edited like it's an action film, which is one thing. I've done a lot of action scenes and they are very entertaining to do, you know, as it's sporadically, not as a, you know, constant thing. But it's it's another thing when you actually have to make it hit the music that people are singing and dancing to, and then create like an effective edit through that, because it becomes so much more difficult a jigsaw puzzle piece to put together, a jigsaw puzzle to put together. So I was really astounded by the editing work in this film. I think on a story level, one of the fundamental problems I've always had with West Side Story is that the romance itself, as the central conceit of it, just never worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
It always felt like it was underbaked, and I didn't buy this immediate romance between the two leads in it. And this film really didn't solve that problem for me. So it's like the whole thing, everything that's going on in the periphery of the two main characters, I think is great. I love that stuff. Everything that has to do with the romance of the two central characters, I don't buy for a second and doesn't work for me. And that's always been the biggest problem I have with West Side Story.
I don't think it helps this version much either that Ansel Elgort is so flat. Yeah, he's generally pretty good. Like I've liked him in other stuff, but he just feels like vacant here. There's like zero screen presence when he's on screen, which is really disappointing, because that's part of, you know, like you say, like the selling point is this romance at the center of the story, and there's just nothing from his side. Like nothing. It's just like dead air. I was like, what happened? Because he can be good. I've seen him in stuff that I've liked him in. But can't win them all, I guess. Can't win them all.
I agree.
I was trying to watch what was left before the awards show, because I still had a list of things that I wanted to get to, and I didn't finish, but I did manage to get a couple of other things squeezed in. One of them was Coda, which I knew I wanted to see months ago, and for whatever reason, just kept putting off.
So I put it off
until literally like 4 days before the Oscars. It's really, really sweet, really, really well put together. I mean, it's not my favorite movie of last year. It's not the best movie I watched last year, but it's really, really entertaining, very sweet. Sean Hedder's done a really great job here. And it really does, for me, it lives and dies with the family. And that family is like tops. Mailee Matlin, Troy Kotsur, Daniel Durant, and Emilia Jones, who plays the only hearing person in the family. It's really good. And it really touches on some interesting ways that we communicate that you don't really think about, just because, you know, half of the people in the audience, most of the people in your house don't hear. It's just very, very interesting. The thing that struck me the most was how she acts as a translator for the family. And that like was a direct, for me, it felt like a very direct translation to like the immigrant story, where there's usually one person in the family that acts as translator for everyone. And that was always my role, was I'm the one that translates the family things to whoever I need to. And that, the weight of that, I think, really comes through in the story and was a bit of a surprise to me. So I thought that was a really interesting sort of parallel that was unexpected. It's really solid. It's a really great little movie. So I don't know. I don't have much to add beyond that.
I mean, it won Best Picture, so I'll get around to seeing it soon.
I will say it's not saccharine. Like, that's the thing that I hate the most about like dramas that are just a little too on the nose. This one does not come across like that. It feels really like authentic and real, which is really nice. Really, really nice. And I'll quickly just mention the other one only because I want to move on from the awards stuff. I also watched The Tragedy of Macbeth. I have very little to say about this other than it's probably one of the better adaptations of Macbeth that I've seen. The cinematography from Bruno Bedinel is like amazing. The stark black and white is just stupendous and on another level. And the woman that plays the witches, Catherine Hunter, I think she's a stage actress. She hasn't done a lot of film work. Her scenes are like they're already some of the most interesting, because the language that Shakespeare used for the witches has always been really interesting and maybe one of the most memorable parts of this play. But holy shit, the physical performance is on another level. And there's a couple of scenes in particular in this movie that are like fucking ingrained in my mind and I can't get them out, and they're creepy as shit. It's really, really well done. It's not going to be for everyone. It is as Shakespearean as it gets. And Denzel is delivering lines with gusto. Frances McDormand is right in there. There's some really great moments. I mean, it's another interpretation of Shakespeare, but I'm not sure if I would recommend it to everyone, but if you're a fan of these adaptations, I think it's definitely worth checking out. And there is some really great, just sort of like filmmaking stuff happening here. It's hard to recommend because it's just such a depressing story that to me doesn't really go anywhere. Macbeth has never been one of my favorites, so I'm like, eh. But it's there. It looks great. I'm not doing much to sell it because I just don't even know what to say. It's really not for everybody, but if you're looking for something that's a little more challenging, that looks stupendous, you could do much worse than Macbeth. Mm. Yeah.
It just seems like such a, I don't want to say swerve, but not what you would expect from Joel Cohen.
No.
Just do like, here's a Shakespeare movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, admittedly, it's a pretty straightforward Shakespeare. It's not like, what's his name? Oh, God. Like, Branagh, when he adapts Shakespeare, he does do, like, a bit of a, not an alternate reading, but he has his own reading of the material that comes across in the filmmaking, which makes his adaptations quite unique, I think, for me personally. This feels like a very straightforward adaptation of Macbeth. The interesting part of it is the visual. It's not necessarily the themes that, you know, he's trying to take from the text. The visual storytelling is the thing that is striking about this adaptation. And it's worth checking it out for that. But I want a little bit more out of my Shakespeare. So that's why I'm kind of like, well, you know, it looks really great, but it's not doing anything new with the material.
I guess seeing Denzel do Shakespeare too. It's like there's, I don't know, I think there's a certain appeal there because he's definitely a very kind of like a larger-than-life actor.
Yes, and he does Shakespeare, yeah. I've
never really seen him do, you know, stage production-type performances
before. And not on this level. I mean, Much Ado About Nothing he has a role in that, but it's quite a bit smaller than this, and it's a comedy, it's not a drama. Mm-hmm. But I mean, honestly, for me, that is probably the best of the adaptations that Branagh has done. It is so good, and if you haven't seen it, worth checking out. But this is definitely solid. Just not for everybody.
Fair enough.
Okay, I haven't seen this yet, and I'm a bit disappointed I haven't seen this yet, but Turning Red.
Yeah, so this is the new Pixar movie, which is about a young adolescent Asian girl in Toronto, or Tarana, as people in Toronto will say. That's basically growing up and dealing with the dichotomy of having overbearing oppressive mother, being a child of immigrants, and trying to have a life of her own as she's basically coming into, you know, young maturity. So at that nexus point in her life. And at the same time, a lot of this gets facilitated through, all of a sudden, she starts turning into this giant red panda. And she discovers that it is essentially a curse/gift that she's inherited in her family, that at a certain age she will basically just start turning into a red panda when she gets too emotional. and that they found a way to basically, like, you know, relieve all the women of this family of their curse. And before this ceremony can take place, because it has to take place during a red moon, she just kind of has to try to, like, keep her life in check. And so she's balancing this whole other thing, which becomes a metaphor for her essentially going through adolescence, and essentially finds that she enjoys the freedom that comes with being the Red Panda. She starts to get positive attention from it, from other kids, and it allows her freedoms that she didn't have before. And she feels like she is capable of so much more when she is as the Red Panda. And so she's all of a sudden being torn between two different worlds and still having to deal with her mother and what her mother wants for her life. And so it, very similar to Everything Everywhere All at Once, it's dealing with a lot of those same themes, where it's immigrant mother passing on the trauma that was passed on to her daughter, and the daughter coming, and both the, and the mother coming to realize that she doesn't actually have all the answers to stuff, and maybe her daughter is capable of making decisions for herself about what she wants in life and finding her own truth that was not hers. So it's, and it, the movie itself has so much energy. It's so lively. It is so fun and infectiously energetic that it is hard not to just, like, find the thing delightful from beginning to end. And it feels really fresh and original, even though on the surface it may seem like, oh, I've seen these elements in so many other animated kids movies, especially Pixar movies. And sure, yeah, we have. But this movie really felt like it was, had enough of a fresh perspective and was interesting enough that I found it absolutely delightful and fell completely in love with this film.
Oh, that's great to hear. I
recommend this one highly enough. This may actually be up there with my favorite Pixar movies of all time.
So, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan of Domi Shi. She's a really great director. The fact that she was given the opportunity to do a feature film after the success of Bao was really great. Mind you, she did win an Oscar, so it would have been a stupid move on Pixar's front not to give her the opportunity to do a feature film after that. But I'm really happy to see that she's getting some great success with this. It looks like such a fun movie. I'll definitely have to try to catch up with this one in the next week or two. I should also mention that the Vancouver International Film Center, along with the Directors Guild of Canada, is doing a free talk with Domi Shi. I'll link to the registration on the website because I can't remember what day it is. It's sometime in the middle of April, I think. And it's totally free. So if you're interested in tuning into the making of the movie, I'll link to it and you can register there. Cause off top, I just can't remember when exactly that's happening. But that's good. That's fun to hear. I finally caught up with Deep Water after your recommendation from last week. And I don't think I'm kind of as high on it as you were. I still think it was really, really well done. Watching Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas was kind of awkward. Maybe yeah. That was the, it is totally awkward. Yeah, I don't know.
I mentioned this before, but I think it's to the film's benefit.
I agree.
Be a marriage that's essentially on fire from the time we first meet them.
But the thing is, like, it feels like that marriage is on fire from the time they got married. Like, yeah. There's so much, like, the backstory. I kind of wish there was more backstory. Like, I both wish there was more backstory, and I'm kind of glad there isn't more backstory because I think it would just, like, convolute the whole thing. But it just feels like these two people don't belong together. They're just basically fuck buddies that have ended up, like, married and living together. But not really, I don't know. They're not really a couple, per se. It's such an odd little movie.
Such a toxic marriage.
Totally. And I think it's fascinating to watch for that. And they're both so, so good. It really creeped me out in a way I did not expect. Especially Ben Affleck, because he's just uber creepy in this thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Uber creepy. And from the very first moment where he's like, well, yeah, I killed that guy. And I'm like, did he really kill that guy? Did he really kill that guy? I think maybe he did kill that guy.
That's the thing that I find interesting. There's no real solid answer to that, but
no,
like to put this guy off who's hitting on his wife, he basically alludes to this guy that everyone in the community knows has been missing and just says, oh yeah, I murdered him. And it's a joke.
Or is it?
I played into it. And then as the film goes along and Ben Affleck legitimately does murder people, it raises the question, wait, was that the first person he killed? Or was this other guy he mentioned, was it not a joke and he legitimately killed this guy? And you never really given an answer to it. And you don't really need to be given an answer to it. And everyone can come up with their own answer. And it could go either way.
Yeah, no. So,
and I think true. That's part of what's entertaining about it. It's
clearly agreed.
Capable of killing this guy.
Yeah, right? And
kill someone and get away with it and start joking with people that you killed them. It's like just begging to be caught.
And Tracy Letts is so good. So good. I'm like, I had so much fun with him. He is so good in this thing. The fact that he's playing like this wannabe Hollywood writer. And I'm like, wait, what? I'm like, okay, that's pretty good. This movie just seems to be having way too much fun. And it really does work. The more I talk about it, the more I think maybe I did like it more than I thought I did.
I feel like I've heard you around on it.
Well, no, because I mean, I did like it. I finished and I was like, holy shit, that thing was like unexpectedly, like really much better than I thought it would be. And it left me feeling really uncomfortable. And mostly because I like Ben Affleck. I think he's like, you know, kind of this troubled soul of a person that, you know, sometimes that comes out on screen and it's really good to watch, but I don't want to feel like he's creeping me out. And he fucking creeped me out.
Yeah. No, he's very creepy and very intimidating in this.
Yes.
And he is the protagonist.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's the person we're following. And
yes.
Not a good person.
No, no, not at all. There's just, this movie shouldn't work as well as it does. Mm. It's like this trick. It plays a trick on you. It's very, very good. So Deepwater on Amazon Prime, people. Ashley already recommended it. Gets a recommendation from me. Time to cue that one up. It's a good one.
Yes.
GameStop, The Rise of Gamers. Oh my God. What is this thing that I've never heard of?
This is a documentary that I've been looking forward to. Which is basically all about the whole GameStonk thing that happened, I guess, a year ago at this point, where basically the short part of it is that a bunch of online retail traders discovered that hedge funds were basically overplaying their short position on the company GameStop because they were convinced it was basically the Blockbuster of games and was going to go bankrupt. And so they were basically leaning on it and kept buying up short positions so that when this company eventually failed, they'd make a bunch of money off of its stock tanking. And when a bunch of people online discovered that these hedge funds were actually vulnerable and that GameStop was actually not going to go bankrupt anytime soon, they started funneling a bunch of money into buying stocks of GameStop. And it turned into this big online movement where all of these people were individually, as a collective, buying mass amounts of stocks of GameStop to the point where the price of GameStop just skyrocketed. It went up like 400%. And some people made a lot of money off of the stocks for GameStop. And hedge funds that were shorting this thing, they lost their shirts because they all of a sudden had to be good on, you know, the fact that the stock was like skyrocketing. And so it ended up, what plays out essentially, it feels like this kind of David and Goliath type story where you have these ordinary people with no power but access to big small nominal trades, and if you can get enough of those people together, it can actually affect the mechanism that is Wall Street, which is basically designed so that, you know, it supports itself and keeps other people out. And this is the documentary that essentially follows all those original people who like started this whole thing before exploded into a big online Reddit movement, and follows that cultural movement as well into how the whole thing plays out. So it ends up being like a timeline of like, well, what the fuck happened there? If you only like tacitly like saw in the news, because it exploded into a huge story at the time. If you only sort of like were tacitly aware of what was going on, or just like noticed a few headlines after like most of the smoke had already cleared or whatnot, or were even like following it through like the week or so that it became like this just exploding nonstop story like I did, then this one goes through like here's the players from the very beginning. Here's how it got where it got, and here's where it ended up, and here's why things played out the way they did. Mm-hmm. So it's done in an entertaining enough way that it is engaging. At the same time, it also doesn't feel like there's necessarily enough story here for a full feature documentary. So it is interesting because it's a subject I was interested in already, and I wanted to see it, but I wouldn't go so far as to call it a great documentary. So it's all going to depend on what your interest level is of the subject material. It's it's sort of like the whole Theranos thing. It's like if you're already obsessed with that story, then The Dropout is great. And same thing, if you're already obsessed with the whole GameStonk story, then this documentary is great.
Okay, so it might not be for me, but I'm still very curious, only because the whole thing was just like a huge what the fuck is happening moment for me, so I'm curious to learn a little bit more. So definitely,
and it's interesting just from an educational level.
Yeah, you know, okay.
Just to see what happened, because it was kind of an unprecedented moment in history.
For sure. Yeah, okay. How about Sweetheart?
So This is a movie that is like it's a little bit older. It's like 2019, but I finally caught up with this movie. It's been recommended to me. It's a much smaller film, but the premise is just like it's undeniable. It's like, what if Castaway, where you have this one person alone on a deserted island and they have to survive, making do with what resources they can find. But every night there's a monster that comes out of the ocean looking for food. That's what Sweetheart is. It is this woman who washes up on a deserted island, starts like cracking open coconuts and building shelter and like, you know, trying to survive on this deserted island, and then discovers at night there's this vicious creature that comes out of the ocean looking for, basically trying to eat her every night, and she's, you know, trying to protect herself and stay alive on this deserted island. And so it's one part survival movie and one part horror movie, and it works extremely well. It's a great, perfect little premise that's done well, is really entertaining. If this movie has any downside, it's probably that it's like a smaller budgeted film. And I think the monster design isn't really quite there. It works great in darkness and in quick flashes when you see stuff, but it's definitely one of those, the less you see, the more effective it is. And as it gets on later in the film and you get to see the monster in full view, it's like, maybe it should have kept him in shadows.
Okay, adding this to my watch list.
Other than that, I thought it was a great little movie. I enjoyed it a lot.
I really liked Dillard's Slight, which I thought was a really solid... the trailer suggested sci-fi, but it really isn't. I thought it was a really great film, so I'm excited to check this out too. Okay, adding it to the watch list. Done. Death on the Nile.
Yes. So I finally caught up with this. And I'm going to preface this by saying that I still have not seen Murder on the Orient Express yet.
Neither have I.
I need to go back and watch that one. But I decided to watch Death on the Nile because it's very much a genre that's like in my wheelhouse. Stuff that I love. I love that the murder mystery party film is making a comeback. We have Knives Out. We're going back to Agatha Christie books. You know, it's just I love that stuff. So it's it warms my heart. I will say though, however, I've never been in. The biggest fan of the Poirot character. I don't know, I've just always found him a little bit insufferable. And so maybe that's the thing that kind of puts me off a little bit. However, I will say this, that much to my surprise, Kenneth Branagh infuses the character with, I think, just the perfect amount of humanity. And a little bit of whimsy where he's still kind of like a bit of like a, you know, braggart kind of, you know, better than thou type character, which you kind of go along with because he's the guy who solves the mystery. But like he walks into every scene and everyone fawns over him because he's the great Detective Poirot who can do no wrong. And, you know, he's this huge celebrity, but he, you know, Branagh plays it like he carries himself very quietly and, you know, it's very kind of like humble in himself and builds it in a way that he does so because he's basically just like, he's a detective because he's masking the trauma from his life, essentially. He's a guy who's hiding from himself.
But, you know, that seems like so much at odds with the TV series, right?
Yeah.
Which is what I remember of Poirot.
Yeah, and so the movie plays into that aspect of his character just enough that I think it makes Poirot work more for me. And the film itself is an absolute delight. I think Branagh is definitely like, he feels like he's very much in his element with this film. The dialogue is absolutely crackling, and I thought the writing was so strong for this film. And you know, it's if you're familiar with the story at all, it's like a bunch of rich people on a boat sailing the Nile, and murders start happening, and Poirot's going to figure out who the murderer is. And I hadn't actually read the book or seen the other film adaptation of Death on the Nile, so I didn't know exactly how this one plays out. But it's entertaining enough once you get to the solution. And just the journey itself, I thought was incredibly enjoyable. Performances are good. The visual presentation is absolutely delightful. And the writing was just like really sharp. It's the type of like barb-tongued noir writing that I absolutely love. So I fell in love with this film. I'm going to go back and watch Murder on the Orient Express, and hopefully that one will be as good. And yeah, my memo is yes, please do more Branagh. Please do more Poirot movies because I enjoyed this one a lot, and I would love to see a whole series of these.
Nice. Okay, so this means I'm going to try to watch them in order because I do have the Murder on the Orient Express somewhere. Because I had planned on seeing it and then never got around to it. So I'll have to do like an Agatha Christie double bill, I think.
I don't think it matters too much watching them in order because they're kind
probably of like not
their own thing.
Yeah.
But
I might as well watch them both.
I don't know how well this movie did. with like worldwide, it did $134 billion, which I'm guessing the budget's pretty high for this movie.
Probably not a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of feels like it was just in theaters like last week. I know it's not, it wasn't, but it kind of feels that way. So, yeah, I expect it probably didn't do huge.
Yeah, budget was $90 million, so that doesn't bode well for getting
No. I'll just quickly say I went and rewatched The Batman. I went with a friend who hadn't seen it yet. So I still love it. Don't get me wrong. Still love it. Probably still one of my favorite movies of the year. Definitely still one of my favorite movies of the year. It still plays really well on a second viewing. Not quite as well because the seams are a little more visible. There's a lot of stuff that I don't love, which is much more glaring on a second viewing. That said, it still kicks fucking ass. It still looks amazing. And the Batmobile is still the greatest thing on screen in the last decade, as far as I'm concerned. It is still the greatest moment ever. Well,
Batmobile is more or less just like a muscle car.
Oh, dude, when that thing starts up in the dark, it's just like, I still giggle. It just, even in the trailers, that sound just cracks me up. It's just like the best, like, growl thing. I don't know what it is. It totally works. And of course, I watched, the Dolby has a really awesome podcast on their YouTube channel. And they did like an hour long conversation with the audio team from The Batman. And they talked a little bit about the Dolby Atmos technology and how that was used in the movie. And I mean, I know what Dolby Atmos is. Do I know how they use it to make movies? No. So it was really interesting to kind of get into like the nitty gritty technical of it. So of course, in some of the scenes that they talked about, I was like, well, now I can pay attention because I've already seen this. And wow, it's super impressive. So. Mm-hmm. Still plays well second viewing.
I think it's a great example of why it's a good idea to hire horror filmmakers to make these types of movies.
Yep.
Like especially like what you're talking about with the Batmobile, like when it comes like bursting through the fire, like it's Christine and John Carpenter.
Yes. Like, yes. Well, and it even has that body style, right? I think that's very specific.
Yeah, and even though the car is more or less, it's just like, it's a souped-up muscle car what it really is. But the way it's presented in the film, it's presented like it's in a frickin' horror movie.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with getting David Sandberg to make Shazam, and I think that's one of the reasons why I love that movie so much.
Yes.
It's horror filmmakers understand genre and how to play into the conventions and against the conventions of these types of films. And I think Matt Reeves' background of doing horror is definitely what helps play into making the stuff in the Batman that does work really well.
Agreed. I mean, I will say I've always been predisposed to Matt Reeves. Cloverfield was a movie that Dan and I watched. I don't even remember how many times. It was one of the first things that we bought on Blu-ray where – like we watched all of the extras. We watched that movie like a dozen times at least because it was just like, I haven't seen it since then, but I think it's time for a revisit because I've been a fangirl for a long time. So I feel like I'm fangirling over Matt Reeves a lot, but I just think that this movie is so.
It's even a genre that I particularly love, but I do like Cloverfield a lot.
Yeah, no, he's a great filmmaker. So so good. Okay, and I want to finish with two TV series. So the first one is season 2 of Bridgerton. Okay, so season 2 of Bridgerton there is not a lot of smut, which is what I want to talk about. So actually, I had this discussion with somebody else the other day because I got a message from a friend. He's like, have you seen Bridgerton? I'm like, I'm partway through it. I'm feeling gypped because we are now already at episode 5 and there has been like zero smut. So, you know, we were talking about, because I mean, I haven't rewatched season 1, but I clearly remember there being quite a bit of it in season 1. So what's happened? I'm convinced that the Bridgerton team is probably, they're clearly fans of this genre and they know how to do romance. Like any good author knows how to do romance, which is you give the fans what they want at the beginning and then you play with them. Because season two is like the perfect calculated slow burn. Because nothing happens for 7 episodes. And then, like, literally, like, nothing happens. I think there is, like, at one point, halfway through the season, there's this moment where the two leads have, like, a moment where they lean into each other and, like, he touches her chest and it's, like, played for, like, high drama. And you're like, of course it is. We haven't seen anything in 5 episodes. The fans want it. So it was like season one was the perfect setup for the delivery of season two. I don't know if they can pull that off again for season three, but it's really well made. I mean, it looks beautiful. It's really funny. Jonathan Bailey and Simone Ashley are wonderful. They have really great chemistry. I mean, I don't really know what else to say. It's not season one. It's its own thing. And it works. But yeah, there is not anywhere near as much smut. If you're looking for smut, watch Sex Life. Way more smut than that, like a lot of it. So there you go. That's my smut recommendation for the day.
We need to have like a whole kind of like section that we can have with the theme song where it's like, here's your smut report.
Oh, dude, I'm in for it because I can give you all the smut reporting. And then I wanted to finish with Halo. Feels a little premature to be talking about Halo since they've only aired 2 episodes and I've only seen the first one. Mm-hmm. But I did want to talk about this because... I'm not quite sure this series is going to last past season one, unless they have some like weird shit up their sleeve. Cause I'm telling you, I don't know. I don't know anything about Halo. I know it's based on a video game and that's kind of all I know. Like, I don't know what the Halo is. I know there's this dude called Master Chief. That's kind of it. Like, that is my entire knowledge of the Halo franchise, but I really like Pablo Schreiber a lot. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to give this a go because he deserves to be seen. Episode 1 is very violent, but it doesn't really set anything up. Like, I'm not 100% sure who the I expect the audience for this series are people that play the video game. Because as somebody that has never played it and doesn't know anything about the universe, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? One, who is this dude? 2, what is happening on this planet? And 3, why do you need an entire army to try to stop this guy? Plus 3 special forces dudes who are clearly important and all powerful to stop one special forces dude that you've lost control over. So I don't know. I'm just not sure. Just not sure.
I'm probably gonna get people like shouting at their phones or their computers or whatever they
do it.
But I've played a little bit of Halo, not much. It's not really a game that I've ever really found particularly appealing. So I've mostly ignored it. So like you, I don't know that much about the story of it. But from my understanding, Halo doesn't actually have much of a story. It has lore. And I mean, lore is not story. It's background. And the rest of it, it's just like it's, you know, first-person fighter shooty-shooty stuff. And that's the video game, and that's what's fun about it. But there's not that much story there. It's more like the story that is there is like the conceit to make the action happen. And so I understand why they'd want to make a show around Halo, just because it's this huge property. But it's kind of like Mortal Kombat in a way, where there really isn't much story there. It's just two people fighting, and then you fight another dude, and then you fight another dude. And when you try to build a story around that, it can get really difficult to try to like bring the video game to life, but also create all the stuff that doesn't actually exist in the game. And I haven't really heard anyone talking about this show at all. It's like people don't even really seem to have an opinion about whether it's good or bad. I'm not even sure many people are even watching it. It's just kind of like it's popped out and like no one's paying attention.
So, yeah, I think there's definitely like I think there's definitely a marketing issue here because Paramount Plus has dropped this on their like I don't know where the difference is between the Canadian version of Paramount Plus and the American version of Paramount Plus because it's apparently available in the States on the app, but in Canada, like I pay for Paramount Plus, it's not streaming on Paramount Plus. That's not where I'm watching it, so I don't even know where you would get it. So I think that that's
kind of like the HBO problem we have.
Yeah, it's the Crave. Exactly. So that's problematic. I think that there's an opportunity here because I mean there are interesting things in that first episode, at least that I thought were really interesting. Like there's a race of another race of aliens that is also looking for this item that Master Chief has uncovered. And so there's clearly like some history there and it does hint at some interesting things to come. I think what's kind of, what might be working against the show is it feels both really expensive and really cheap at the same time. Like some of it, like the stuff on the opening planet, that big battle sequence looks like it was shot somewhere. And then they've like applied some red filter to it to make it look different. And it makes it look weird. So it just looks cheap. But then you see the spaceship stuff. And you're like, well, that looks kind of like they blew their entire load of special effects money on that. So I don't know. I'm kind of like, I'm just not 100% sure about it. So it might be premature because it is only one episode. But I feel like that same thing. Like nobody's talking about this, and I don't know why. Because you figure somebody would have an opinion. Like you have the internet has opinions about everything. What the hell? So I don't know. I will say Pavel Schreiber is undeniably awesome. Hopefully the show is good and lives up to, you know, what he's capable of. We will see. I will report back after more than one episode.
Maybe I'll hit his stride, but I have not been moved to seek the show out.
Yeah.
Things to watch and I don't care about Halo.
Yeah. Well, apparently I do, even though I know nothing about it. So there's that. Okay, so the last thing I want to mention just in passing, it has nothing to do with movies or series. I watched Saturday Night Live last night, and Pete Davidson had another one of his musical numbers.
I saw this only because it came across my Twitter feed. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, shit, people are going to be tagging me in this sort of thing.
Dude, it is the greatest thing ever. I'm like, this is my official theme song from now on. Because it's kind of genius. Oh, what do you think?
I don't know. I think it's kind of indicative as culturally where we are. Like the, you know, for people who haven't seen it yet, the whole thing was basically just this rap about how
movies are too long.
so freaking long now. It's like, it's like, just give me a short ass movie. And it rattles off a lot of movies that are, you know, an hour 40 or less, you know, some good and some bad, but you know, I think it's definitely responding to a popular sentiment that's like, movies are just too freaking long right now. And I've been trying to reverse engineer or figure out exactly how it is we got to here. How is it we got to here where we're just like, yeah, 3-hour Batman movie. And 3-hour movies are nothing new. We've had those before. And I remember in the 90s, there was like a whole bunch of 3-hour movies that we got. But at that time when those came out, they were all like very big prestige drama type films. It was like Braveheart and Casino and Nixon. It's like these were the movies that were 3 hours. Your average, you know, popcorn movie was not a 3-hour movie. It just didn't happen. And I think there's multiple reasons why. And I think chief of which is we were still shooting on film. So the prospect of making a 3-hour movie became all of a sudden very expensive. And now that everything has moved to digital, the only added expense to having a 3-hour movie is the number of days you have on set to shoot it. And sometimes it can just be a case of like, okay, because all these movies are half the time are going into production without a finished screenplay in place, we'll just keep shooting a bunch of stuff and add a whole bunch of scenes together and we'll figure out in the edit and you end up with a 3-hour movie. And we've started to become sort of accustomed to it because it's become the norm now that movies are just getting longer and longer. And there hasn't really been much pushback until now when you're starting to see that. And I mean, I became Twitter's villain of the day for, you know, for basically suggesting it's like, hey, movies need to earn their runtime. It's like my rule, and I'm an editor, so I have a kind of vested interest in the process of like pacing of films. That is my job. And I'm very kind of interested in what the correct pacing for films should be. And my rule is always that you need to respect your audience and that you should expect that an audience will give you 100 minutes for free of a film. And everything past 100 minutes, that film needs to justify its continued existence on an exponential level while you're still watching that. So that still accounts for your 3-hour movies. If you're watching Goodfellas, it's a great movie. It earns its runtime. You don't get to the end of that movie and say, wow, that could have lost 20 minutes. You do, however, get to the end of The Batman and say, I could easily cut 30 to 40 minutes out of that.
I disagree, but okay.
You know, as much as there's stuff in that movie I like, there's no need for it to be as long as it was.
True. That's very opinion. True.
And there are plenty of movies these days where I can make that argument. And like some people have said, there's just the expectation with like the big action, you know, superhero blockbusters. It's like, well, you have to squeeze in this, this, and this, and this. And so you have to cut out all of the story stuff to fit the time. And so that's why they get so big. It's like, kind of, but at the same time, Venom 2 came in at like 110 minutes, something like that. Felt very nice. And I went back and looked at it. I was like, okay, so why was this film able to come in at 110 and basically do everything that all the other Marvel movies are doing? It's like, oh, they cut out one action scene. That's it. They lost one action scene from the movie. I didn't miss it. I love action scenes. This is not an anti-action scene thing, but you know, it's like you don't have to have the movie that like has everything in it. And I think when we're making these movies be as long as they are, we're losing things in the process.
I fully agree. Fully agree. Fully agree.
Yeah, I think the SNL bit that Pete Davidson was is kind of like a more mainstream cultural pushback against the state of North American filmmaking and the length of the average movie.
Yeah, I don't think it's gonna change anything, but it was certainly fun and I went, yes, please, could we please bring back the 90-minute movie? Please. I want more of those.
Theaters would love it.
They could squeeze in more movies.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I work a lot in TV and you sort of see this, like, it depends on the show you're cutting. If it's going to broadcasters, it's like, okay, well, I need to, like, hit this very to the frame specific target of how long this episode is. It's like there's no ifs, ands, or buts. This is how long your show is. If it's going to streaming and not a broadcaster, it's like, we can make it as long as we want. Doesn't matter. It's all just content.
Yeah, you have a little bit more wiggle room.
Yeah, which is nice because it is really hard getting stuff exactly to the frame when you're like, crap, what am I cutting out? But at the same time, it allows you to get sloppier and not have to make the hard choices. And a lot of times, I think some of the best filmmaking happens when there are more constraints put on the filmmaker, not fewer.
Okay. I can totally get behind that for sure. Because I will say that second watch of the Batman, there's certainly moments there that could be taken out. I love them. Don't get me wrong. I would love to see them as an extra on a Blu-ray release, but I think you're right. There are a lot of movies that could do with a little bit more editing. It's the same with books. Like at some point, authors just stop being edited, and it's like, okay, that's when things get out of hand, and you stop, and you're now a sloppy writer that I can't read because it's just too much. I'm sorry. Anything else before we call it a day today?
No, I think that's good.
So come on by atcpod.ca. We'll link to all of the things we talked about today, including the little bonuses we discussed. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with more movies and TV talks. So until next time.
Insert catchphrase here.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.